Hello there. Today is Friday, March 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the global COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, health officials urge people to change their interactions.
We've got to try as best as we can to distance ourselves from each other.
U.S. airstrikes in Iraq after a militant attack kills two American soldiers and one British service member.
The United States will not tolerate attacks against our people, our interests, or our allies.
Also ahead, Lady Gaga has a newly discovered insect named in her honor. It's all on today's International Edition. The escalating coronavirus emergency sent the stock market in the U.S. and globally into the worst slide here in the U.S. since the Black Monday crash of 1987, extending a sell-off that has now wiped out most of Wall Street's big gains since President Trump took office. This as workers lost jobs, children stayed home from school, and people fretted over dwindling retirement accounts, the health of elderly parents, and every cough and sneeze in their midst. The world sports schedule cratered at warp speed, with one of the biggest events on the U.S. calendar, the fun-filled college basketball tournament known as March Madness, becoming the first mega event to be scrubbed due to the fear of spreading the virus. Leaders at all levels of sports decided that the risk of playing games with the threat of the virus hanging over them was just too much, despite the billions of dollars, to say nothing of trophies, pride, and once-in-a-lifetime experiences hanging in the balance. Public health experts, meanwhile, say they still don't have a good understanding of how widely the new virus has spread. As the pandemic spreads, though, there is growing criticism in the United States about the lack of availability of tests for the virus, tests that are available in many other countries. VOA's Ira Melman has more.
Less than 10,000 Americans have been tested, according to lawmakers, while other countries have been able to complete more than that number of tests every day. The reason for that is that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, chose the wrong way to administer the test, according to Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Fauci appeared before a congressional hearing in Washington Thursday.
The system is not really geared to what we need right now, what you are asking for. That is a failing.
It is a failing.
I mean, let's admit it. The fact is, the way the system was set up is that the public health component that Dr. Redfield was talking about was a system where you put it out there in the public and a physician asks for it and you get it. The idea of anybody getting it easily, the way people in other countries are doing it, we're not set up for that. Do I think we should be? Yes, but we're not.
I spoke with Dr. William Schaffner, a professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University and a former CDC inspector, about the problems with testing.
I like to look forward rather than back, but I will acknowledge that there were glitches in putting testing widely available out throughout the United States. We all wish that that had gone smoother and faster. But now that we've got it, let's do it and find out where the virus is in this country.
So how do people try to stay away from those who may subject them to the virus? Dr. Schaffner says by doing just that, by staying away from other people.
I've been impressed. The concept of social distancing is really being heard, and people are trying to apply it. Many colleges and universities have now said we're going to online learning. We're not going to gather together in classes. Businesses have said we're not doing meetings. We're having much less travel. Sporting events, I think many people are not attending sporting events. They'll watch them on television. So we're avoiding crowds in order to not become face-to-face, quite literally, with the coronavirus, because that's the way you get it. You get close to someone who's sick or who has the virus, they breathe out. If you're within 3 feet, you breathe in part what they have exhaled, and then you can get affected. So let's stay apart from people to reduce the risk of transmission of the virus.
There are many questions that remain. One of the biggest is how long the coronavirus will be around.
There's no real way of telling. Now, what we all hope is that this coronavirus, a respiratory virus, acts like other respiratory viruses. Influenza, for example. And we all know influenza is very seasonal. It goes away once spring and summer start. There's a hope that this coronavirus will do that, but we're not sure. On the other hand, this coronavirus may actually go south of the equator. While we in the northern hemisphere have summer, they have winter. And there could be coronavirus epidemics in Australia, New Zealand, Southern Africa, and all of South America. So we'll have to wait and see. And then, of course, it could cycle back and affect us in our winter once the winter starts. So I think this coronavirus is likely to be with us for a while.
I'm Ira Melman, VOA Asia.
Well, addressing the nation from the Élysée Palace, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a speech to the nation there, called the new coronavirus the most serious health crisis France has faced in a century. Macron called on the population to remain united and to trust the science-based approach to the epidemic. Reporter Nico Pinault joins us now from Paris. So the president there taking some pretty big steps to fight this.
Well, the major announcement President Macron made is that he just announced the closure of all the nurseries, the schools, universities in France, and it's going to start next week. It's similar to what Italy did. It's a major step in the crisis here in France. It goes for days, even for weeks. President Macron and his government say they would not close all the schools, only temporary measures when you have clusters of the outbreak. So it's very important what he announced.
Obviously, being so close to Italy and also, of course, with this virus spreading so rapidly and indiscriminately, it doesn't seem that borders really matter at this point. So obviously, this is a very big deal. I understand he called it the most serious health crisis France has faced in a century.
That is correct. His tone was quite dramatic because, of course, right now in France, we have about 60% deceased because of the outbreak, and you have above 2,000 cases, which is far less than what you have in the neighboring Italy, where you have 15,000 cases and you have more than 1,000 people who died because of the epidemic. But President Macron said that they have to fight together, all the European countries. And he also mentioned that he's going to talk to the U.S. President Donald Trump on Friday to discuss a joint response of the outbreak. We know that the United States, they are leading the G7 group, and that's why he's going to have this phone call. And obviously, the context of this phone call is also very important because President Donald Trump announced a travel ban for EU citizens to the United States. So it's going to be very important. And President Macron said division won't allow us to tackle what today is a global crisis. And instead of calling for resolve on our ability to act together, that's what he mentioned in his speech.
Did he mention anything about preparedness as far as having enough hospital beds, having enough tests available and things like that?
He did not mention specifically the tests, but he said that non-essential surgeries, they should be postponed to make space in hospitals to be able to have patients, sick patients with the COVID-19 to be able to go to the hospitals and have rooms for that. And he also called for people over 70 to basically stay at home to avoid contact with the public.
All right, that was reporter Nico Pinault in Paris. Well, the travel ban President Trump announced Wednesday night appears to have blindsided Europeans. They believe his national address was a push for isolationism and fear of foreigners. Here's a short version of the EU's reaction read to reporters by the European Commission's chief spokesperson.
The coronavirus is a global crisis, not limited to any continent. And it requires cooperation rather than unilateral action. The European Union disapproves of the fact that the US decision to impose a travel ban was taken unilaterally and without consultation.
Joining us to talk more about that part of the story, Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, it sounds like French President Emmanuel Macron was also not so subtly directing some of his comments at President Trump.
There were quite a number of occasions, really, when you felt that the French president was directing his remarks to the US president. In particular, Emmanuel Macron kept talking about needing a science-based approach to the coronavirus and a science-based approach to our reaction to it and to measures which the government is taking. He also called very clearly for all decisions to be taken in the light of a sort of a national solidarity, a fraternal humanity, and not from a nationalistic perspective. And that really did come across. And even though he said he is going to speak to the American president on Friday, he said that's going to be in the context of calling for a G7, the seven most industrialized nations, the G7 coming together to approach not just the health aspect, but also the economic impact of this coronavirus. So we're seeing very much the French president deciding that this has got to be something that's dealt with on an international basis and not by single countries taking its own decisions for its own people.
How, in general, are Europeans reacting to this travel ban that President Trump imposed?
The first reaction to it really did come from the European Union, which said that it was really completely disproportionate. It said that it wasn't taking into account the science, that it didn't take into account the science which they're relying on for their own reactions to the coronavirus. Particularly, the European Union was saying that just closing down borders in some countries isn't going to be enough. So that was their big reaction. Here in France, of course, Emmanuel Macron was really quite disturbed by it. And when you actually go on the ground, for example, here in Paris, there were scenes at Paris Airport during the day of Americans being prepared to pay any figure they could to be able to fly home, to make sure that they get a ticket home, to get onto a plane back to the United States before planes stopped flying over between Paris and Washington, D.C. There was one incident where a group of Americans got together and they were trying to actually rent, to hire a private jet just to make sure that they got back to the United States.
It seems like it might be easier to say, you know, everybody working in a unified front here, but it seems like more and more people are wanting very separate borders and border checks.
Indeed. When you look at, for example, Germany, it's reimposed border checks to France. They're making sure that anyone coming into the country is not showing signs of a temperature or a fever being some sort of illness. You've also got Austria that's introduced border checks with Italy. Slovenia has also introduced border checks. And you've got Hungary, which says it will reinstate border checks. So you're looking at individual countries saying that they have to have some sort of check. And even though we're not seeing a return to the days when there were really very rigid borders within Europe and between countries, you're seeing more and more countries saying, well, we do have to put in place some sort of check at our borders, because that is, of course, the next problem for Europe, is they know that at the moment they have the healthcare capacity to deal with those becoming ill with this coronavirus, but they are still concerned that that healthcare capacity could be exceeded.
That's Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Experts say the Trump administration's ban on Europeans coming into the U.S. will also be adding more trauma to another layer of hardship, an already devastated travel industry. Joining us for that part of the story, hospitality and tourism management expert Andrew Coggins, a professor at Pace University Business School. Obviously, the priority has to be keeping people safe and healthy, so it's understandable. But how much might this compound what's looking like a pretty big disaster for the travel industry?
That's like the third blow of a trifecta. The first one was shutting down the Asian routes, which is understandable. And then the second one is people are reluctant to fly now. If you go to the airports, there's less people. The planes are empty. And then the North Atlantic route has been the premier, most lucrative, busiest transportation artery going back for passengers, at least to the packet ship days in the early 1800s. And so now that's stopping tomorrow night. And it's going to really impact the tourism industry. So I think we'll see major effects next week in Las Vegas, Orlando, New York City, Washington, destinations for European tourists. And then it's going to have an impact on business because European business people won't be able to travel to the United States.
But would you say it's a necessary evil, or do you think that this is just sort of going to actually do more harm than good?
I think it's probably going to do more harm than good because the virus is already in the United States. You can screen the people before they get on the plane for fevers. And if they have a fever, they can't fly. For example, when you land in Hong Kong, you pass a temperature measurement station on your way to immigration. So if you have a fever, they'll probably pull you over and make you go through medical checks before you can come into the country. So I think the screening that could have been done at the airport without the major economic interruption that's going to come from that ban, because I believe it's for 30 days. So it's going to be really felt. The foreign tourists actually spend almost twice as much per capita as the domestic tourists spend.
If Europeans wanted to get into the United States, couldn't they just hop on over to the UK?
They could probably go to the UK, but I believe that if they have to have not been in the Schengen region in 14 days. However, you know, it's a question of how truthful they want to be because their passport wouldn't be stamped until they came into the UK. And I don't even think it might be stamped for them coming into the UK. They just have to go through immigration as being going into the UK now. Because I think they can still travel without barriers for another few months under the Brexit arrangement. For the airlines, they lost their Asian market. And so the outbound Chinese market is 100 million a year. So that's a substantial blow. And now they're losing their European market. So especially the international ones are really hurting. They're going to have to lay off people. They're going to have to cancel flights. They're going to have to lay up planes.
But would people be traveling anyway, given the circumstances? Are they losing business because they're of the ban, or would they have been losing that business anyway because no one wants to fly?
Well, I think they would have lost some business because people being reluctant to fly, but business people would probably still fly. And tourists that had already booked the trips and would be facing heavy cancellation penalties would still make the trip. It's going to be like 9/11, but right now, I don't know, because there's not an end in sight.
Our hospitality and tourism management expert, Andrew Coggins, he's a professor at Pace University Business School. In other world news, we're following a U.S. federal judge Thursday ordered that former U.S. Army soldier and WikiLeaks source Chelsea Manning should be immediately released from prison, where she is being held for refusing to testify in an ongoing U.S. investigation of WikiLeaks. An entry in the U.S. District Court docket in Alexandria, Virginia, also rejected by the judge, a request by Manning to cancel fines he had imposed for her refusal to testify and ordered her to pay the fines, totaling $256,000. A spokesman for Manning's defense team said she had attempted to commit suicide, had been taken to the hospital where she is recovering. Facebook and Twitter revealed evidence Thursday suggesting Russian efforts to interfere in the U.S. presidential election are getting more sophisticated and harder to detect. The company said they have removed dozens of fake accounts and pages from their services. Facebook said the network of accounts was operated by people in Ghana and Nigeria on behalf of individuals in Russia, while Twitter said accounts it removed tried to sow discord by emphasizing social issues such as race and civil rights without favoring any particular candidate or ideology. And the European Space Agency and Russia's Roscosmos said Thursday they're postponing a planned joint mission to Mars until 2022, in part due to travel restrictions resulting from the new coronavirus. You can find many more stories at voanews.com. Well, the Pentagon confirms the U.S. has conducted airstrikes across Iraq against the Iranian-backed militia Hezbollah. President Trump authorized the strikes in response to Wednesday's rocket attack in Iraq that killed two American troops and a British service member. Defense Secretary Mark Esper stopped short of blaming Iranian-backed Kataib Hezbollah or naming a specific militia, but said the U.S. will not tolerate this.
The United States will not tolerate attacks against our people, our interests, or our allies. All options are on the table as we work with our partners to bring the perpetrators to justice and maintain deterrence.
Well, joining us now live on the phone with the very latest VOA Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. Carla, thank you so much for being with us at this late hour.
Of course, yes. It's been a very busy time at the Pentagon. The airstrikes targeted 5 weapon storage facilities belonging to Kataib Hezbollah. They have been the ones who have been blamed for this attack, as you said. The Pentagon actually described these strikes as defensive, proportional, and in direct response to this strike that killed 2 American soldiers and 1 Brit. They added that they wanted to target the weapons depots because they wanted to degrade their ability to conduct future attacks against coalition forces. And now, while this was not an announced strike, it was certainly not unexpected. Top defense and military officials had sort of hinted that it was just a matter of time before the U.S. responded. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper and his top U.S. military officer, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, briefed reporters, and I was able to ask Secretary Esper, I said, what should we expect? What do you want to tell Americans and Iranians who are concerned now that we're going towards war? And this is what he had to say. Do we have that audio?
I do not have that audio, unfortunately. Please, if
that's
you could
okay.
Just let
I
us
can,
know.
I can explain. He basically told me, he goes, we're going to take this one day at a time, but you don't get to shoot at our bases and kill and wound Americans and get away with it. And as you could see, we saw the strikes coming out.
Right.
And while you did say that Kataib Hezbollah was not mentioned by these officials, General Frank McKenzie, who is the top commander of U.S. Central Command, which oversees those U.S. military operations in the Middle East, he was speaking on Capitol Hill today. And while he didn't pinpoint them, he did point their name out and said that Kataib Hezbollah has been the only group to have previously conducted indirect fire attack at this scale against U.S. coalition forces. So not exactly saying they did it until after they launched the retaliation attacks, but pointing to them all day.
Who are they?
So Kataib Hezbollah is an Iranian-backed proxy group in Iraq and also in Syria. They do not like the United States being in the Middle East. General McKenzie had said today that that is one of Iran's goals. They want to push the United States out of the Middle East, and they're starting with Iraq, and they're using Kataib Hezbollah to try to push the United States out of Iraq so it can destabilize the region. Kataib Hezbollah, you've heard that name before, because in December, an attack by this militia killed a U.S. contractor at a base near the city of Kirkuk. It's the K-1 base there. The U.S. responded back in December with retaliatory strikes, hitting several different Kataib Hezbollah locations, and then went further and killed Qasem Soleimani. That was the Iran Quds Force commander. And then that was what escalated everything for the entire beginning of 2020 between the United States and Iran. It culminated with an attack from Iran on Al-Assad base in Iraq, which houses U.S. troops. No one was physically hurt on their body, but we found out later that there were some traumatic brain injuries and concussions that happened because of that attack. But the U.S. decided that because there was no one physically hurt, that they felt that it was over and that they had deterrence restored against Iran. But while it may be restored against Iran, the government and the entity and the sovereign nation, they are still using their proxy forces around the region to still strike the United States.
All right. We appreciate it. That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb coming to us live via the phone. We appreciate it so much. Thanks for the update.
Thank you.
And you're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Construction work has traditionally been a male-dominated field in the U.S., but today more and more women are choosing to build their career in business. Karina Bafarazian met with some inspiring women who work in construction to find out what attracts them to this tough business. Anna Rice narrates this report.
A 9-to-5 office job isn't for these women. Instead, they work construction. And they do it for the same reasons the men do, because they find construction work more fulfilling.
Being able to see the bigger picture, being a part of something bigger. So driving by the building, be like, I built that building, to your family or to your kids in the future. That's kind of why I did it, just to be a part of something bigger.
Before they start working, these women take a mandatory training course at a special center. And many of them say it teaches them not just to construct buildings, but also build a harmonious relationship with themselves.
I think it's, for me personally, it's a constant battle on gaining confidence, but this job has definitely helped it. I don't think I would be as confident as I am now working in another field.
Today, women make up about 10% of all construction workers in the country. All the workers need are a few tools, a helmet, special protective glasses, training, and self-confidence. Kelly Kupchak has been working in construction for over 2 decades. For the last 3 years, she has been head of the Tradeswomen Organization, a company that has been helping women in Portland, Oregon, to master construction work for free. Kupchak also helps them find a job, something a lot of them need because it's harder for women to break into the business.
I also saw some really hard things, and I experienced some really hard things as a woman in an industry that's still dominated by men, and an industry which I think is changing, but back then it was still largely this very macho, like, why are you here? Why are you here taking my job? Why are you here taking a job from another man who has to feed his family? And I was like, I have to feed my family too. So that was a big eye-opening experience for me firsthand.
Bridget Quinn trains future electricians, including those who came to the construction industry with the help of tradeswomen. She says that on top of the basics, she also needs to remind women that the issue of gender and physical strength should not stop them from doing what they really want to do.
There's tiny men out there, and there's big muscular women out there. There's times when having a smaller stature is going to be more beneficial in our industry, and there's times when being bigger is going to be more beneficial in our industry. And I think that especially as we grow as an industry, as far as safety concerns go and safety training and things like that, we're always learning how to do our jobs with the least possible damage, repetitive use, destructive use to our bodies. And so we've got so many more tools nowadays that we can use to be able to do heavy physical work.
Every year, more than 1,000 women graduate from Tradeswomen Training Center, ready to build houses for others and a new life for themselves. And Kupchak is doing all she can to keep that number growing. For Karina Bafarazian in Portland, Oregon, NRI's VOA News.
A just-discovered insect has been named after Lady Gaga. Gaga's flamboyant style inspired the name of the Kaikaya Gaga, a new species of tree hoppers. They're an insect found near the Pacific coast of Nicaragua. Entomologists, scientists who study insects found the new female tree hopper had unique features that were very different from the others, just like Gaga. Brendan Morris, a PhD candidate at the University of Illinois, said, if there's ever going to be a Lady Gaga bug, it's going to be a tree hopper because they've got these crazy horns. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us online at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day and be well. Now it's time to free.